Miami Beach's plans for raising the minimum wage hit a roadblock with the Florida Supreme Court. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. With three new conservative judges, the court decided not to even hear arguments in the Miami Beach case to raise minimum wage. Will it all come down to the voters? Also, what should our region make of President Trump's State of the Union last night? How will his shift on immigration impact people living in South Florida? And what's he going to do next in Venezuela? And Israel may not be known for baseball, but in 2016, they put together a ragtag bunch of players to compete in the World Baseball Classic, where they beat Cuba. We're going to take a closer look at a documentary about the team. And finally, Craig Morris teaches trumpet at the Frost School of Music. He's nominated for a Grammy, and he's going to be performing live today in studio. All of that coming up on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, the Florida Supreme Court recently shot down an effort by Miami Beach to increase the city's minimum wage. This continues the ongoing battle over Florida cities setting their own minimum wages. It's also being seen as one of the first significant moves by Florida's newly shaped Supreme Court under Governor Ron DeSantis. WLRN's Danny Rivera reported on this story, and he joined us yesterday to talk about this stop to the minimum wage ordinance.
So what this case represents is actually a pretty stark contrast between what the court looked like 2 months ago and where it is now. Because last year, the Supreme Court agreed to hear this case. And then now we have three new justices that were appointed by our new governor, Ron DeSantis. And then now the court's coming back and saying, well, actually, we changed our mind. We don't want to hear that case. So they didn't even hear the arguments to it. They just said, we're not going to hear it. So the lower court's ruling on it, which shut it down. That's what stands right now.
All right. Tell us a little bit more about the Miami Beach law minimum wage that was blocked and who proposed it and why it was proposed.
So this law was proposed and brought forth and passed in 2016 under former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine. It was a little bit of a ballsy move. You know, there was a little question about whether the city could do this or not, because there's some conflicting legal theory on what's actually the state law on this. There was a 2003 law that said the state, that no municipalities or counties can set their own minimum wage. But then there was a ballot initiative that passed in 2004 that the city said preempted that, which means that the cities can set their own minimum wage. So that was what they were operating under. So they passed it, and then, you know, immediately it got taken to court.
And who was involved in that lawsuit?
But it was a lot of the big business organizations, the Florida Chamber of Commerce, the Florida Retail Federation, Florida Restaurants and Lodging Association. They took it to court. They said, listen, the 2003 statute that was passed is the law here. And then that says, if you're a municipality, you can't pass your own minimum wage. We need one flat minimum wage all across the state.
All right. So obviously, as you mentioned, you know, one of the main arguments against municipalities from changing the minimum wage is the impact that it could have on retailers. What did you hear from retailers?
So one of the big concerns that retailers across the state had, and this is reflected in some of the legal filings, is that if cities or counties are setting their own minimum wages, then you could have like a patchwork of different levels that people are paid across the state. So you can have Miami Beach there, it's at $13 an hour. The city of Miami, you'd have $8 an hour. Hialeah, $10 an hour. So they're saying this would cause a lot of confusion, especially for chains that might be operating in, you know, many different counties at a time. It would just create a lot more red tape, and you'd need more administration to deal with all this stuff. So they said, you know, the most business friendly way to do this is to have one flat rate and then just leave it at that.
What did this teach us about the Supreme Court appointees that Governor Ron DeSantis has put in and how they might likely vote in the future?
So this is undoubtedly seemingly a more pro-business decision. You know, again, no arguments were heard here, but the fact that they weren't willing to entertain even hearing the arguments does say a little bit about where they're going to be coming from.
You talked with former Miami Beach mayor, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Philip Levine, who had some choice words about the Supreme Court decision.
So I think the Democrats need to wake up and say, hey, if you want to get these issues passed, if a higher minimum wage is an important issue for you, you better have candidates that can win, because otherwise you just keep talking about it and you won't get anything done. And I think that if we had won in November, we would have had a Florida Supreme Court that would have been more fair, more just, would have heard this argument, and who knows, possibly they would have sided with the people of Florida.
Okay, it sounds like he's really angry about not winning the primary, but is he basically putting the blame on Andrew Gillum?
You know, talking to me, he did somewhat, he didn't mention him by name, but he said, you know, Florida's not a progressive state. So Florida basically ran the wrong candidate. And his theory on this is that as a party, you know, they need to start, the Democratic Party needs to start electing centrists, because that the party's been losing across the state basically for over 20 years now. So he says, you know, they picked the wrong guy. You know, he didn't say you should have voted for me, but that's kind of in the subtext. But, you know, beyond that, he was telling me, you know, elections have consequences. For whatever reason, Democrats didn't win here. Now we have three new Supreme Court justices in the state, and they were a part of this decision. So if a Democrat was in there, this whole thing could have looked differently, which is true.
Someone replied to you on Twitter saying, not a surprising result from a legal standpoint, but definitely means any change to the minimum wage in Florida will have to come by ballot initiative. So basically now, if we're going to move forward on any conversation on minimum wage, it has to be on a ballot?
That is one theory, and it's worth mentioning. John Morgan, the, you know, powerful attorney, he is...
the guy who pressed for medical marijuana legalization on the ballot.
Exactly. He's pushing to get this on the 2020 ballots, and, you know, pretty soon he's already stated that he's going to be turning in over 100,000 signatures for that ballot initiative.
And, his initiative is for a $15 minimum wage.
Yeah, across the state, which would... we could be looking at that next year.
Do we know if there's going to be any conversation in the Florida legislature this session on minimum wage?
There has been a bill introduced that would raise the statewide minimum wage to $15 an hour. Under the, you know, current dynamics of who's in office and who's in the governor's mansion, I think the prospects of that actually passing and going through are very low. For progressives and Democrats, this is something they're going to continue to hammer on until there's some movement on it.
That was Danny Rivero talking to me yesterday, shortly after the Florida Supreme Court declined to hear any arguments in the case of Miami Beach's effort to increase the city's minimum wage. You can read more about this story at WLRN.org. Now, transitioning from state politics to a bigger scale, a national scale. In President Trump's State of the Union address last night, he spoke at length about his administration's immigration plan and, of course, responded to the crisis in Venezuela. But amidst his comments about MS-13, funding the border wall, and immigration reform, one line stood out for Politico's Mark Caputo.
I want people to come into our country in the largest numbers ever, but they have to come in legally.
Mark Caputo is senior writer for Politico and behind the Florida Politics Playbook. He joins us now to discuss that and more. Mark Caputo, always great to have you. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate being here.
All right, let's start with President Trump's unexpected comments. I mean, at least from what I've read on Twitter, very unexpected about the immigration, saying again he wants to see the largest number of immigrants come in, but legally. What are the implications of those comments for the people living in South Florida?
Well, let's start big. The implications of those comments for President Trump is that he is contradicting his administration advisors' policies, where they wanted to restrict the inflow of immigration, legal immigration, into the country. And so how this sudden turn, this 180-degree turn is going to happen is really unclear. And the president has a perfect opportunity. In fact, all the political leaders in Washington have the perfect opportunity to overhaul, modernize, and improve the nation's immigration system if they took the 2013 bipartisan legislation for comprehensive immigration reform that Senator Marco Rubio had championed in the Senate, passed there, died in the House, and Republicans refused to even to countenance it. So there is a roadmap. There's ability to do it. Fact is that President Trump's party, the Republicans, really don't want to do, quote-unquote, amnesty. And Democrats have now hardened more and more along this idea of not wanting a wall. I do assume that if it were ever possible really to get the leaders in a room and everyone in a room, that they could actually wind up passing that legislation, But the reality is he can't get everyone in that room, so I assume no legislation is going to be passed.
Well, why do you think he brought this up yesterday? Is it just rhetoric, or is there something here that he's making a shift?
Well, President Trump really wants his wall. And so he's now dangling some carrots out there because the sticks haven't really worked. President Trump had effectively took credit for shutting down the government, which led to pretty disastrous consequences, and did not give him what he wanted, which was the wall funding. So now he's, again, on the carrots instead of the sticks, and this probably is some sort of olive branch to kind of start to change metaphors here, vegetal metaphors, and find a way to get Democrats to come across and meet him halfway or whichever direction it is.
And we don't know. There could be another possible shutdown. He's still pushing on this wall. But what do we know from Florida lawmakers? Are they shifting at all on this argument, his debate over the wall again?
Not that we're seeing. But again, the Democrats' position is hardening against a wall. And there was wall funding in that bipartisan legislation I referenced just a moment ago in 2013. Again, though, I think if reasonable minds prevail and if they want to pass comprehensive immigration reform or immigration reform, it can be done. There's a roadmap. There's legislation. The question is there the political will? If they are going to do it, 2019 is the year to do it because it's not an election year. 2020 is just probably going to be impossible to do immigration reform. But we've seen this immigration reform show time and time again, and it's never ended well. It might change coming up. You don't want to say no. Politics is the art of the possible. President Trump has certainly shown himself, charitably speaking, facile with his positions. So we can't say that he's locked into something and he'll refuse to countenance anything. But there are a lot of different factors and vectors at play, especially in the U.S. Senate, which has become far more conservative now than it was in 2013 when it was controlled by Democrats. Now it's controlled not only by Republicans, but much more conservative Republicans as well.
So the president, of course, discussing the ongoing crisis in Venezuela and U.S. support for opposition leader Juan Guaido. Let's take a listen real quickly to his comments.
We condemn the brutality of the Maduro regime, whose socialist policies have turned that nation from being the wealthiest in South America into a state of abject poverty and despair.
So the crisis in Venezuela, Mark, is this something that both sides agree on what the next step should be?
By and large, I think there is pretty good bipartisan agreement that the sanctions need to continue against Venezuela as long as Maduro is still the leader, and that Guaido should be recognized as the interim leader. Now, where we go beyond there, that's a great question. If the administration decides to commit troops, it's going to be a really messy situation. And he hasn't ruled out using troops. So then again, a president never wants to kind of take options off the table. You at least need that threat out there if you're to be taken seriously. At least that's been the U.S.'s position for a long time. However, the United States' history in military involvement in Latin America has charitably not been such a good thing for history. One of the reasons there's a lot of hard feelings against the United States is because of some of our foreign policy in the past, both in South America and beyond. That having been said, notably, the president didn't mention one thing that Venezuelans stateside say we need, which is the TPS status, which is kind of temporary protective status for Venezuelans who are fleeing here from the regime. If the administration is really serious about taking the Venezuelan exile community's feelings at heart, this is one way to welcome them. Democrats and a few Republicans, including Miami Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, say, hey, look, we need TPS for Venezuelans. But that was totally absent from the president's speech. And in part, one of the reasons for that is there's a segment of his base that doesn't want to admit more immigrants and certainly doesn't want to extend TPS because though it's called temporary, it can sometimes last for decades.
Yeah. How much do South Florida congressional leaders, I guess, really have any sway on the president when it comes to Venezuela, especially like U.S. Senator Marco Rubio and what we do next?
Well, so far, all the indications are is that Senator Rubio has a lot of influence in Latin American policy in the Trump administration. President Trump has deferred to Rubio. Rubio has a pretty hawkish, hardline position. And years ago, Rubio had said that Venezuela is the new Cuba, because the Cuban security forces were intimately involved in the way in which Maduro and the regime were cracking down on dissidents and, you know, people they didn't like. And the United States policy is also similar in Venezuela to the way it is toward Cuba, albeit we don't have kind of a full embargo, but we're, you know, starting to march toward that if the current trajectory continues. However, you are asking me kind of a trick question. What influence does anyone have with President Trump? Again, the president is kind of very facile, and it's difficult to tell where the administration is definitely going to go from one day to the next. He keeps people guessing. That's probably both a weakness and a strength, because certainly foreign opponents, the Maduro regime, is probably wondering just what the heck he's going to do next.
Well, I promise if it was a trick question, that was by accident. So, you know, the other thing, too, though, is Nicaragua. And obviously more of the conversation is on Venezuela. But what do you see in Trump's policy or the U.S. policy towards Nicaragua? Is it getting overshadowed?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's getting overshadowed to a degree because Venezuela is such a crisis. It has 1.3% inflation. That's just staggering. They've had millions of people leave Venezuela. It is the largest peacetime migration we've ever seen in this hemisphere. So when you have the largest proven oil reserves in a nation and the formerly richest Latin American country suddenly struck by poverty, people unable to get cooking oil, yeah, that's going to kind of overshadow what's going on in other countries in Latin America. But Ortega is certainly looking at what's happening in Venezuela, Ortega being the president of Nicaragua, and he's going to be wondering, well, am I going to be next? And this is where the administration so far has, at least in the eyes of its bipartisan, you know, the bipartisan members of Congress, the administration so far has not applied too much force but too little, and is winning plaudits. If that continues, if there's a successful resolution in Venezuela, then I think Ortega is probably going to feel a little more pressure. There are other extra-regional players here, Russia and China, which benefit from opponents of the United States being in office. So that's also something that is at play here as they engage in these kind of multilateral talks in this very dynamic situation we're having in Latin America.
We're talking with Mark Caputo, writer for Politico and author of the Florida Politics Playbook, and we're talking about President Trump's comments on immigration in Venezuela during the State of the Union. Now let's shift over to the 2020 election because, hey, why not? We got 2 years. Let's start talking about it now. You know, we got a growing field for the 2020 presidential election on the Democratic side. In what ways, though, do you think that the Venezuela issue could play out for Republicans in Florida?
This is kind of there could be some sort of wedge politics being played here, or at play here, I should say, is that while state and local Democrats in Florida are supportive of a harder line on Venezuela, there are Democrats in other parts of the nation, in Congress, who have, I'm trying to phrase this diplomatically, a bit of a softer line when it comes to Maduro in Venezuela. And specifically, Representative Ilhan Omar has warned against having a right-wing coup, as she calls it, even though Guaido is not right-wing. And you have Bernie Sanders, who at times has not denied that he's a socialist. And so you could see a wedge-type politics at play here. Republicans see an opportunity to grow their support beyond Cuban Americans, who tend to vote more Republican than Democrat when you look at Florida's Hispanic vote.
Yeah, you're talking about the Hispanic vote you're trying to grow.
Correct. However, part of the problem that the Trump administration or Republicans are going to have is the Republican Party's rhetoric over immigration. Again, its refusal to countenance things such as TPS, not just for Venezuelans, but other Latin Americans, are going to kind of suppress their ability to grow. What we did see in the last election, albeit it was a midterm in 2018, was Republicans did a little better with Hispanic voters for two reasons. Cuban-American voters who kind of sat out the presidential election came home to the Republican Party, and also the turnout of non-Cuban Hispanic voters who tend to vote Democrat was a little lower proportionally. And as a result, when you look at the exit polling, when you look at some of the precincts that are kind of bellwether precincts for Hispanic voters of different ethnicities or nations of origin, you see that the Republicans did relatively well. Rick Scott, elected the U.S. Senate, and Ron DeSantis elected as governor. They probably wouldn't have been able to do it, especially Rick Scott, who only won by about 10,000 votes, if they hadn't done so well, relatively speaking, with Hispanic voters.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, and Republicans also have that new leadership. Senator Joe Gruters recently took over the party. He was on the program here, and he told us his sole mission, get Trump reelected. Who's leading the Democratic Party in the state, and what's their plan?
Well, that is a great question. I'm gonna once again call it a trick question, even though it's not. Nikki Fried is the only statewide elected Democrat now. She's the agriculture commissioner. That's not an office, however, that really commands a bully pulpit. De facto, as far as the voice in the Democratic Party, despite Mayor Philip Levine's implicit criticisms of Andrew Gillum, is still Andrew Gillum. He's a very influential voice in progressive politics. He's a dynamic speaker. He has a big footprint that is just beyond Florida. So he's kind of the de facto leader of the party. But really, there isn't one. This is what happens when your party's not in power, both in the White House and the governor's mansion. You're going to have kind of a messy primary to figure out who that is. And boy, it's looking like a pretty messy primary. I've lost count of the number of Democrats who have announced, let alone major Democrats who have announced. On Friday, Mayor Bloomberg, former mayor of New York City, is going to be down talking to an immigrants' rights coalition. He's looking increasingly likely that he's going to run. So he's just going to add an extra name and about $50 billion of net worth to this race and probably help change the dynamics a bit as well.
Oh, and there's probably going to be more. We got lots of time. You know what? Talking about Gillum, though, I mean, this ethics controversy, is that going to follow him? Is he going to be an asset to the party with that?
Well, it certainly doesn't help. And that's probably one of the factors that cost Gillum his election against Ron DeSantis. But at the same time, depending on how he handles it, I don't think it's going to be as big a deal. Look at President Trump. He has weathered a whole host of scandals, and he's still president, and he still has his base. So while I can't say that these ethics problems with the State Ethics Commission have helped Andrew Gillum, and certainly didn't help him in his campaign for governor, it's difficult to say that's really going to be a killer, considering the current political dynamics we're seeing out of Washington.
All right. Jim DeFede on this program once said that maybe Democrats have to rethink Florida, considering how it's gone over the last few elections, and maybe put their energy elsewhere. I mean, Florida's still a key state, right? Or do you think that's an idea that maybe, hey, skip it and put the money in other states, try to win elsewhere?
That's an easier argument to make for Democrats if it weren't for two things. One, they keep just barely losing. You know, Ron DeSantis only won by 30,000 votes out of 8.3 million cast. Rick Scott won by just over 10,000 votes out of about 8.3 million cast. So this is a place where Democrats can win. In addition to that, Florida is the largest swing state in the nation. It's the third most populous state in the nation. It's got 29 electoral college votes, which is more than 10% of the total needed to win the presidency. Generally speaking, although the last election didn't show this, generally speaking, Republicans need to win Florida more than Democrats. What that means is that if Democrats carry Florida, it more than likely kills the Republicans' chance of either capturing or holding on to the White House. If you look into the 2018 election results in the Rust Belt, in the Midwest, those areas appear to have drifted away from Trump. If that trend continues, it increases the importance of Florida to President Trump and therefore to Democrats.
And you know what? We have about 22 more months to talk about this. So
awesome. Awesome.
Plenty of time. Mark Caputo, again, writer for Politico, author of the Florida Politics Playbook. Mark, always a pleasure.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
All right. Thank you. And a reminder to folks, Sundial has announced its February book club title. It's our first nonfiction book. It's entitled The Jews of Key West by Arlo Haskell. The book dives into the fascinating history of the Jewish migration to our southernmost point and the impact that the community has had on the development on the island. Join our Sundial book club. Find our Facebook group. It's free to everybody. We welcome everyone, and we'd love to hear your thoughts as you read the book. Now, still to come, Israel put together a baseball team to compete in the 2016-17 World Baseball Classic. They did surprisingly well with a bunch of unknown players. We're going to learn about a documentary on that team coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, back in 2016, Team Israel shocked the world by not only qualifying for the World Baseball Classic, but beating the powerhouse team Cuba and making it to the second round. Now there they lost to Japan. The team had barely taken shape with predominantly Jewish American players, for many of whom this was their first experience traveling to Israel. The new documentary, Heading Home, The Tale of Team Israel, tells the story of the players rediscovering their faith and their heritage. Filmmakers Daniel Miller will be in South Florida this Friday at the David Posnack Jewish Day School for the opening of the film Across South Florida. And he joins us now from NPR Studios in New York. Daniel, it's such a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we should say, by the way, that this is a bit of a homecoming for you. Your father lives down here in Miami.
He does. He lives in North Miami Beach. I am half Cuban, I will say. So although I don't speak Spanish, I'm very well versed in all the Cuban restaurants down there.
All right. So welcome back when you get here. You know, watching this film, one of the first things that jumped out at me is like, I wondered, what does baseball mean to the citizens of Israel? Do they care about the sport?
Well, the answer, pretty directly, is not in the least. I think, baseball has very deep roots in the Jewish community, however. I think just by virtue of that, baseball is one of these sports that is kind of passed along, between generations, the legends of these kind of baseball heroes. And it's something that was always like, it was very easy to play in like the inner city. It's a game of immigrants. So Jews were always sort of naturally drawn to it. It hasn't really picked up in Israel except among the immigrant community there from the United States, who have started leagues, who have really started to get it going, who have in the process of building a couple baseball fields. And they're even trying to get together a 2020 Olympics team for Israel baseball. So, but, it's as a result of this movie and as a result of Team Israel's success in the World Baseball Classic, baseball is really starting to pick up steam in Israel.
When did the idea and how did the idea to make this documentary come up?
I think, like many great ideas, this idea first finds its origins at Jewish sleepaway camp. me and my fellow director, Jeremy Neuberger, we went to a camp in upstate New York called Camp Tel Yehuda. It was a Jewish sleepaway camp, and we went there with Jonathan Mayo. He was into baseball at the time. If you go to Jewish sleepaway camp and you're into baseball, you usually end up being, say, a sports writer, which he became. He's now a sports writer for Major League Baseball. And, we stayed friends through the years. He kind of approached us with the idea to do a film about Jewish baseball players and making their first trip to Israel, sort of a birthright trip, see what it was like for them to experience Israel for the first time. We loved the idea, but we had a lot of trouble raising funds for the project, mostly because a lot of these Jewish baseball players were minor leaguers, not a lot of name recognition. I remember one fundraising meeting we went to for this particular project, and one of the potential funders took out his phone and looked at the Twitter followers of the various players. And he, completely unimpressed, he passed on it. A lot of these players, what happened is they qualified for Team Israel for the World Baseball Classic. The World Baseball Classic is essentially Major League Baseball organizes every 4 years the World Cup of baseball.
Right, yeah.
And a lot of these players were on Team Israel.
Oh.
And as a result of them qualifying miraculously, everyone became interested in the project. So we were able to sort of go ahead, sorry.
No. And something you said a second ago, but coming back to, the players not being really well-known players. And mm-hmm. I thought that was a fascinating part of this film early on was how they were finding these guys. So there's this scene, and they're looking for players, and, they have to find somebody who's got some kind of Jewish background. But let's just take a quick listen to this segment.
The great challenge was finding the guys without the Jewish names.
My dad's side of the family is Irish and Catholic, and my mom's side of the family is Polish and Jewish.
I mean, our shortstop, we got him off of Facebook because his mom looked Jewish.
My manager came up to me, he asked me if I was Jewish, which is kind of a random question to ask. They clicked my mom's Facebook, they saw she's from New York. A lot of Jewish people live in New York, apparently.
A potential player had to prove that his grandparent or his parents were Jewish.
Daniel, that alone, I could watch an hour of that, but I mean, just trying to find the players was difficult.
Right. What, Yes. Well, you know, a rule of the World Baseball Classic is that anyone who is eligible for citizenship in a country is allowed to play for that country's team. In the Olympics, say, you have to be a citizen of the country to play. But in this case, let's say, so if you're Jewish or you have a Jewish parent or grandparent, you're allowed to become a citizen of Israel. Therefore, every baseball player who meets those qualifications can play for Team Israel. A lot of countries take advantage of this rule. For example, Spain's team is entirely South American guys. The team from the Netherlands is entirely from Dutch colonies, Curaçao. It's a huge baseball island in the Caribbean. But, you know, to find the Jewish players for Team Israel was a real challenge because a lot of these guys don't necessarily publicize the fact that they're Jewish, not on purpose per se. But, you know, if you're looking for guys who have one Jewish parent or Jewish grandparent, sometimes those guys are a little challenging to find.
And another aspect of this was that not all of them, but a number of them went to Israel for the first time in their lives. Just briefly, tell me a little bit about that experience for them, because it was very eye-opening and very heartwarming.
Yeah, it was really transformative. You know, these guys, I would say maybe like half the team, 10 or so players, went to Israel. They qualified in the fall, and they went to Israel in January to see for the first time, most of them, the country that they would be representing on the world stage. And, you know, these guys have spent high school, college, their professional career thinking nothing but about baseball. And this was a time to really kind of connect with their faith and their roots and their spirituality. It was really a transformative trip. You know, one kind of really exciting moment, you know, most people go to Israel and they talk about the effect of a holy site, say like the Western Wall, and how that affected them and how it was so meaningful. For these guys, yes, they did go to the wall, but one particular moment that was meaningful to them is they took a graffiti tour of Tel Aviv. And, you know, what they had the opportunity to do during this graffiti tour, where they're looking at everyone else's graffiti, is paint their own. So they painted the essentially a Jewish biblical baseball hero, who is Sandy Koufax.
Yep.
They painted him on a wall. Sandy Koufax, he missed the first game of the 65 World Series because of Yom Kippur. And that sort of has elevated him to epic proportions in the Jewish community. So the ability to do that and to sort of connect as Jewish players and as a Jewish team and to reconnect with who they are really kind of brought them together as a team and made them do so well in the tournament.
I'm talking with Daniel Miller, one of the filmmakers behind Heading Home, The Tale of Team Israel. It tells the story of the Israeli baseball team in the World Baseball Classic. Heading Home opens up in numerous theaters across South Florida this weekend. Another powerful scene, there were so many to pick from, but this was later in the film, and this was as they were playing the Japanese team, you know, as they were getting eliminated. But one of the players was talking about how, even though some of them don't practice Judaism or that, you know, they don't think of themselves much as Jewish, this experience, being on this team, the trip they took, everything has really transformed them. Let's take a listen.
Not everyone on this team was raised Jewish. There's a couple of players that are married to Jewish women or that had a Jewish grandparent. We have the right to exist.
The mensch on the bench is not done.
And you can't deny the Jewish people the way that people in the course of history have tried to.
Daniel, briefly tell me about how this journey changed them, but also the Jewish fans and how they view baseball now and this team.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm talking to you in a world that has experienced Julian Edelman becoming the Super Bowl MVP. You know, so now we think of Jewish athleticism as something that is entirely possible. But I think, you know, even Julian Edelman, he wore his Team Israel hat in support of this team. There aren't that many Jewish athletes out there. And, you know, it's not, you know, Jews are, we're considered, you know, lawyers and doctors and, you know, intellects and accountants. And, you know, we don't do athletic endeavors. And this sort of movie, not just for Jews, but for all people, talks about sort of going outside your comfort zone and still trying and attempting to accomplish great things. I think for the fans, Team Israel had that effect on them. Not only were they able to get behind this Jewish ball team, but they felt that through the Team Israel experience that, hey, Team Israel is able to accomplish something great. Maybe we can, too.
I'm not going to let you go without asking you just because you brought it up. You're Cuban-American, but you also you have Jewish blood. So there was a part of the movie. Anybody who remembers watching the tournament, by the way, the Team Israel played Cuba and beat them in the second round. And that was impressive because Cuba's a powerhouse in baseball. What was it like watching that game?
It was, you know, I sort of, being a Cuban Jew, or as we're called, Jubans, it was a struggle with my own identity in a way, you know? I mean, you always imagine, you know, from your Cuban roots, baseball has been popular in Cuba since the 1880s, you know? And, you know, so many star players are Cuban. To see Israel take them on and to see the world's reaction, even to see Cuba's reaction to a large degree to Team Israel, there was disbelief, there was cynicism. And from Team Israel, just the fact that they were able to, compete against Cuba, but actually win, the intense pride that they felt. It was sort of a swelling of emotions for me. And it was, you know, it was wonderful to see.
Daniel Miller, again, one of the filmmakers behind Heading Home, The Tale of Team Israel, again, telling the story of the Israeli baseball national team in the World Baseball Classic, the last one. And they made a run, and they really impressed a lot of people. And it is a lovely, lovely movie. Whether you're a baseball fan or not, you will enjoy it. Daniel, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, that movie, Heading Home, opens up in numerous theaters across South Florida this weekend. All right, still to come, we're going to meet a music teacher from the Frost School of Music who is up for a Grammy. He's going to perform for us. Get excited. Coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You're listening to Greg Morris's performance of Philip Glass's Three Pieces in the Shape of a Square. The album has been nominated for a Grammy for Best Instrumental Classical Performance. Morris will be among a select group of musicians actually performing during the Grammy's nationally televised pre-show this Sunday. And as we'll hear, that performance won't be easy. The piece is designed so that two performers are moving around the stage in the shape of a square as the song progresses. But he'll explain how that works. Craig Morris, Associate Professor of Trumpet at the Frost School of Music, joining us now in studio. Craig, such a pleasure.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this. What was the initial response to you when you found out you're up for a Grammy? And you're going to be performing there.
Right. I think the initial response was sort of drop your instrument case, you know. I was trying to get out the door to go teach that morning. I actually completely forgotten they were announcing them that day, even though I knew the album had been submitted, but I didn't know what kind of chance it might have. There's a huge number of recordings in that category. And I was on the way out the door and got a text message from my wife who had been following along. Fortunately, someone's keeping track of me. And I just had to stop for a second and say, wait a minute, what? It was a huge surprise.
No, that's got to be a great way to start the day. Before we get to the piece here in a second, I just want to remind our listeners, by the way, that you can listen to him live now in a moment here playing, or you can go to our Facebook page and you could see Facebook Live. He's going to be performing for us. Real quickly, though, remind people of Philip Glass and his contributions to music.
Yeah, sure. So Philip Glass is widely known as a minimalist composer. He was one of the founders of this musical movement, which is based on lots of repetition, simple music ideas happening over a long piece of time. And he's known more popularly through through some of his film scores. He's been a very prominent opera composer, but like I said, I think his film scores are how maybe most people might know him. He did the film score to The Hours, was well known. And there's been a number of other films, films that have his music as the subject, like Kuya and Scotsy. Don't ask me to spell that one, though.
No problem. Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that, so trying to understand how this works, because again, it's you're not static. You're moving around as you're performing. I found some videos of, I guess, one of the original pieces, but with flute.
Right.
Now, you're doing this with trumpet. How does that change the performance?
Yeah, you know, honestly, on the album, all of these things are listed as arrangements. That was, I guess, what the publisher really wanted in this. But honestly, for me, they were really simply, if you will, versions, because I didn't change any of the notes in there. I just put them into the register of the trumpet. So flute is obviously much higher. So I just play them one octave down from the flute part and play exactly what's on the page. So what really changes, and I know I'm biased in this, but what changes this, I like the sound better because it's on the trumpet.
There you go. So you prepared a portion you're going to play for us. Tell us a little bit about this particular arrangement.
Yeah, so this, I'm going to play for you melody number 7. This is from his Melodies for Saxophone, 13 melodies that were actually written, excuse me, written, I need your radio voice, that were written for as incidental music for a play in the mid-90s. And he also used them as a bit of a kind of a workbench as for his upcoming saxophone concerto. So what he did when he wrote the melodies, I was digging around online on his website looking for anything I might be able to play, and something I could arrange or something for undetermined instrumentation.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll let you go ahead and set up. You're gonna set up your trumpet, and while you do that, I just want to remind everybody that you can watch us on Facebook Live. So I'm going to let you go ahead and you got your trumpet with you. You can find us again on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, and you can see this as it's happening. So I'm going to step aside here. Right. Whenever you're ready. Fantastic. Craig Morris, Associate Professor of Trumpet at the Frost School of Music. He was again nominated for Best Instrumental Classical Performance for his album of Philip Glass, 3 Pieces in the Shape of a Square. Morris, again, will be one of the only a handful of artists performing during the Grammys pre-show this Sunday. Let's talk about this piece. I'm just fascinated by trying to understand how it works. Now, there's a photo on your website, which is quite impressive, I think, maybe for anybody who doesn't know how this works. And basically, I mean, this is just podiums in a big circle, and you're walking around, well, you're going to be walking around these and performing. Now, for your piece at the Grammy, so it's going to be a little bit different, but just explain how this works, because, again, the performer's not static. You're performing as you move around.
Right, yeah. These there's 2 pieces on the album that were from a concert in 1968 that Glass put on when he first came back from France, where he studied with Nadia Boulanger and worked with the famous Indian sitar player Ravi Shankar. And when he came back to New York, he really disavowed all of his earlier work and then started writing heavily influenced by these Indian rhythms that he had been working with Shankar. And this eventually delved into this minimalism I was mentioning earlier. Another idea he had at the time was to write out the music, skipping every other staff, so that and setting up the music in some sort of geometric pattern, in this case a square, and laying the music around that geometric pattern, and then having the performer or performers move around the space as they're reading the music. And so the original, you know, if you did it, if I did it, the whole thing live, this is a reduced version I'm doing at the Grammys. If you do the whole thing live, then you have the two performers and they move around a, like a 10 foot or a little larger square, in opposite directions and just reading the music. And as they read the music, they will move, they start moving apart. And what's interesting about this particular piece is as they move apart, the music starts basically identical at the beginning. It starts with one player, and the other player comes in with a virtually identical part. And then as they move apart, the parts become more and more divergent until when they're roughly halfway around the square, they become very divergent. But then they end up crossing, and the lower part gets on top. And then as they finish the trip around the square, it all comes starts coming back. The original material starts coming back in reverse order again, sort of like a giant palindrome. And so you can actually hear at least a reference of the square in the way the music is, the music itself is constructed.
For a performer, though, what's that like in that you are, you're moving from music sheet to music sheet and not missing your place? I mean, what's that like for you?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. And this piece is actually incredibly rhythmically complex. And the two parts also have many places where they aren't really related at all as to what's going on. And so it takes a lot of focus. And
you're doing this on national television.
It's not actually televised. It's on the live stream.
Okay.
But they told me that last year they had a million people watching it on the live stream. So
No pressure.
No pressure at all.
So how are you performing, or I should say, how are you preparing for that Sunday performance? How is it different than any other kind of show that you do?
Well, you know, one, just preparing this piece is really unique in that I just recently, fortunately, got a pedal for my iPad. This may sound like a total non sequitur, but stick with me for a second. The problem is, you know, if the way you perform this piece is to set it up in a giant square in order to be able to read the music, you can't do that everywhere. I mean, it takes 12 music stands, even for the reduced version, for us to read through it. So it's not the kind of thing you can just set up in your office and, you know, play through, unless you have a digital copy with an iPad and a foot pedal. And so it's only until I got that I started being able to play, you know, work on playing it all the way through, which helps immensely. So just the piece itself requires a different kind of preparation. And you know, for the program, the biggest thing I've had to do, honestly, is cut it down to 5 minutes. They wanted a 5 minute version of this 12 minute piece, and I had to cut it down to 5 minutes and still honor the piece and still try to capture the same. It still needs to be set up in a square and still capture the same idea of it starts with material, becomes divergent, and then that same material comes back again in the end.
And who's the second performer with you?
I'm so fortunate. The teaching at the Frost School of Music, my fantastic teaching assistant, Federico Montez, is going to join me, which is wonderful because we're able to rehearse this together here in town and spend real time with it. I'd originally started with some friends of mine in the Los Angeles Philharmonic to see if they could do it. They weren't able to. And then I thought, well, I've got great talent right in my own studio here. So, you know, let's take advantage of that and practice here in town and go out there ready to rock.
What have the students been saying?
I think everybody is a little bit like me, a little bit in shock. You know, I think it's been a big surprise. But I think everyone also, you know, they're super happy for me. And I think there's also, even for my colleagues, a sense of pride. It's a great honor, obviously, for me. And I think it also shows the great things we have going on at the Frost School as well.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm always fascinated when I talk to any professional. And, you know, there are certain awards, you know, for any profession that's the pinnacle. And
right.
So, and it is an honor for you, but I'm just wondering, like, does it change your life?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm still sort of in the middle of that question.
we have to wait, obviously, but, you know, still being nominated.
No, being nominated is huge. Since this category is a combination of two instrumental categories, with one with concertos and the like, and then with a full orchestra, and one with solo performers. This was combined in 2012 into the current category, and there has, since that, there has never even been a wind player nominated. And I don't know when the last time a trumpet player was nominated in any of these solo instrumental categories, you know, even before the 2012. So just to have this, you know, nomination being a trumpet player in a category that's always dominated by violin, piano, you know, strings and piano and percussion, basically, it's a huge honor.
You know what? Those strings and those pianos, step aside.
That's right.
Give everybody else a chance.
That's right.
Greg Morris, again, associate professor of trumpet at the Frost School of Music. And again, he's nominated for Best Instrumental Classical Performance for the album Philip Glass, Three Pieces in the Shape of a Square. He's going to be, again, one of a handful of artists performing during the Grammys pre-show this Sunday, which he said, as he said, it's going to be streaming. We don't have time for that second song, but I'm going to say this is stick around for Facebook Live viewers, because you can stick around after the show.
I can.
We'll get that performance on our Facebook Live. Craig, congratulations.
Cool. Thank you.
Good luck. Congratulations. And thank you again so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's our program for Wednesday, February 6th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, thank you so much for joining us. Find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.